Good evening. The way I generally give talks is that if I happen to say something that you don't understand, it's okay to stop me and I'll try to explain it so that you do understand. I know that there's a lot of times that teachers come to this country and the teachers in this country, they expect to have your undivided attention without interrupting ever. But I don't operate that way. So if you don't understand something that I'm saying, please don't hesitate to let me know. One of the things that's real important in the practice of meditation, well, let me start again. When the Buddha talked about meditation, he said that there are three aspects of the meditation that you need to practice all of the time. First, you need to practice your generosity. Now, this doesn't only mean with material things. It's good to practice your generosity with food anytime that you eat. Actually, if you can share your food with someone else. The Buddha said you wouldn't believe how much merit you get from doing that or the advantages. Let's take a look at that for just a moment. You're in a really rich country. I mean, I've been all over the world and I do understand this. You don't go hungry unless you want to be on a diet. You always have enough food. Okay, before we get started too far, there is some ways of sitting that when I see you're sitting that way, I can't continue. And that's a good example. Please don't cross your legs and don't cross your arms while I'm giving a talk. That's one of the rules that I have to put up with. And it does make sense, because when you cross your arms and your legs, you're closing yourself down to what's being said, and you only pick up about 60% of what's being said. When you're open, you'll get about 90% of it. And this is one of the Buddha's rules for the monks. So when you're practicing your generosity, there are three aspects to the generosity. You practice generosity with your speech, with your actions, and with your mind. You say things that make other people happy. You help in whatever way you can so that there's less suffering. And you hold thoughts of kindness, both publicly and privately, in your mind. That is the kind of generosity that the Buddha was talking about. In Asian countries, they practice their generosity by feeding monks. Monks go out on alms round with a bowl, and we walk around, and people put food in the bowl, and it makes them very happy when we do that. In this country, people say that that's begging. And actually, it doesn't have anything to do with begging. I've gone out on alms round here in California, actually. And what I do is I walk around with my bowl, but I'm practicing loving kindness. And if you see that I have a bowl and you want to put something in it, that's up to you. I'm not asking you to do anything. But it is a good practice to share your food as much as you can. The more you can hold the thought of loving kindness in your mind towards other people, that is a kind of generosity. You wish them well when you're standing in line at the supermarket. What is your mind doing? Grumble, grumble. Oh, I've got so much to do. Everybody's mind is like that. So if you want to help everyone, then you practice sending loving and kind thoughts to all the people in the line, especially little kids. They pick that up really fast. And that can help mom out quite a bit. So the more you can practice your generosity, the easier your life becomes, the better your meditation becomes. It's a kind of mindfulness that is very much needed, especially today, because there's so much greed and hatred that's going around. If you want to change that in the world, your world is here. Change it in yourself. When I teach meditation retreats, I rather insist that everybody smiles. And that means smiles all the time. But it's not just a painted-on smile on your lips. It's a smile in your eyes, a smile in your mind, and a smile in your heart, along with the smile on your lips. Why? Because that helps joy to arise. And when you have joy in your mind, now remember, this is one of the enlightenment factors. When you have joy in your mind is very alert. Your mind is very sensitive to change. When something starts to pull your mind down, some situation in life, it's very easy to notice it. So the more you can practice having joy in your daily activities, the more mindful you become, the more uplifted your thoughts become. The Buddha said, we're the happy ones, and we have to show that happiness. Now, I've done lots and lots of retreats over the last 30 years. I did 20 years of straight vipassana, a lot of that time in Burma. And one of the things that I noticed was everybody was really serious. And they was trying really hard. But there was a tension and tightness. You could feel it in the room when you walked in. And that's from trying so hard. And because you were trying so hard, you never saw anybody smile. So when you start practicing closer to the way the Buddha teaches us in the suttas, the smile is something that helps you not just a little bit, it helps a whole lot. One of the aspects of the Eightfold Path is called right effort. I don't like the word right, because if something's right, then there's something that's wrong, and everything is black and white, and life is not black and white. So I say harmonious when I'm talking about the Eightfold Path. So harmonious practice is this. There's four different aspects of this practice. It's noticing when you have an unwholesome state arise. It's letting go of that unwholesome state and relaxing. Letting go of the tension caused by mind's movement. I'll explain that more in a little bit. Then bringing up a wholesome mind, a wholesome object, smiling. And your object of meditation. And keeping that wholesome object going. Okay, that's part of what they call right effort. I call harmonious practice. The Buddha was trying to teach us how to have an uplifted mind all of the time. The more you can smile, the more that you laugh, the more that you relax into whatever is happening in the present moment, the more contentment you have, the more balance of mind you have. You don't get carried away with emotional roller coasters. Now you start to have these little waves of emotional things, and eventually it just turns into a level playing field. That's what the meditation is for. That's what it's teaching you how to do. How to have a mind that's in balance all of the time. The next part of the meditation that the Buddha taught was, he called it sila, morality. And I know this country is not very, very happy with that word. They don't like the word morality very much. Morality means taking the five precepts and keeping the five precepts no matter what. There is no such a thing as it's okay to tell a white lie. No, it's not okay. Now, what happens when you break one of the precepts? You sit in meditation, your mind is very active. Your mind has all kinds of hindrances arising in it. So if you want to learn what the Buddha is teaching, I suggest this on the retreat. I don't know if people actually follow it, but I know that some do. And that is to take the five precepts every morning. Not as some kind of rite and ritual, and not in a language that you don't understand. Take it in English. Take it every morning as the reminder that during the day you're going to keep those precepts. Now, if for some reason or other you break one of the precepts, can't feel guilty about that. Just notice that you broke the precept, forgive yourself for not being perfect, and then take the precepts again with a determination that you're going to keep these more closely. Now, what's the advantage of keeping your precepts? I had a student, she was in her, I think it was mid-40s in Malaysia. She was really, really good at keeping precepts. She would never consider breaking a precept. She was very helpful to other people. She practiced her generosity. And she came to me and she said, I've never done any meditation and I want to practice with you. And I said, fine. I'm giving a weekend retreat. Come for the retreat. So I gave her the instructions on how to meditate in the morning. And in the afternoon, I went over to her and I said, well, how's it going? And she said, well, everything is going along good. I said, well, how long are you sitting? She said, I can only sit for 45 minutes. And the word only is my key. And I said, well, why don't you sit longer? She said, I was raised in the Western way. I'm not used to sitting on the floor. And my knees are killing me. So I said, you know, there's no magic in the floor. Sit in a chair. Just don't lean heavily into the chair. Her next sitting was 4 hours. She got into the first jhana. This is the first day she'd ever done any meditation. Of course, I wanted to walk up to her and smack her in the back of the head. Nobody's supposed to be that fast with the meditation. But that's the advantage of keeping the precepts. If you say something that's not right, your mind will go, I shouldn't have said that, very quietly. And then you just kind of shake it off and say, well, it doesn't really matter. Not such a big deal. But when you start sitting in your meditation, your mind is very agitated. Why did that agitation come up? Because you broke the precept. See, the meditation is about purifying your mind. When you break a precept, that's the opposite of having a pure mind. So taking and keeping the precepts is absolutely necessary for you to have good meditation practice. And that's a promise. It really does work that way. Another example. I had a student that she was a great meditator. She could sit for 3 or 4 hours, no problem. Sit with strong equanimity. I had to leave Malaysia and go to Indonesia because I was asked to teach there. When I came back, I just walked in the door. She gives me a phone call and she says, I want to quit meditating now. Wow, why? She said, I can only sit for about a half an hour. I'm so restless. And I said, what precept did you break? She said, I didn't break any precepts. Well, no, you can't quit. You have to keep meditating and you have to sit at least 1 hour. So she calls me up the next day. No, I am going to quit meditating. And I said, okay, now let's get serious. You've broken a precept. Tell me which one it was. And she kind of hemmed and hawed around. And then she said, actually, I did break a precept. I like to keep my house very clean. And I don't like insects. In Asia, that's really hard. And she said she just got through cleaning her kitchen and there was a row of ants that started walking across her counter. So she very nicely swept them all up and put them outside. And she came back about 10 minutes later and there's this row of ants walking across the counter. So she went and got some insecticide and killed them. And ever since then, she couldn't sit for very long. I said, okay, now I know what the problem is. I know how to solve this problem. Giving life is one of the biggest and best things that you can do. So in Asia, they have open markets and they have live animals that are in the market and like chickens and that sort of thing, and they kill them right there for you. So I told her, go and buy some animals that are going to be killed and then let them go free. So she did that. And she got 2 chickens and she took them out to the forest and let them go free. Now let's take a look at what happens in the mind of this animal that's about ready to be killed. They know that they're ready to be killed. They're in these little boxes and some guy comes and he grabs one and he watches and hears the friend and is snap the neck and they see that. And then somebody buys them. And all of a sudden, the butcher grabs them. Oh, geez, their mind is really full of fear. A lot of anxiety. Dislike of what's happening to them. But what the butcher does is he takes and he ties the feet up and gives it to this lady. And the lady puts it in the car and goes out to the forest. And now she cuts the string and says, okay, go live a happy life. Now, what happened in that chicken's mind? They went from the worst day in their life, they knew they were going to be killed, to the best day in their life. So when I told her to let go of this animal, I said, you have to let go of the remorse and anxiety of killing those other beings. So she bought two chickens, she let them go free. One of them, as soon as she put it down on the ground, just took off running. And the other one went, oh, 5 or 6 feet, turned around and looked her straight in the eye. She felt immediate relief. Then she went home, she sat for 4 hours. That's how strong keeping the precepts can be. It can affect your meditation very, very negatively if you don't keep your precepts. And it's your choice. You can do it or not. When you keep the precepts, what it does is it makes you generally more mindful about what you're going to do before you do it. And then you have the conscious decision of keeping the precept or breaking the precept. This is a very important aspect of the meditation. Now, the last part of the meditation is the sitting practice and the mental development. I'm not going to say sitting practice because it's all the time practice. And that's learning how to watch your mind when it gets tight and tense and has situations that it doesn't like and what it does with it and how much suffering you cause to yourself. And you can make the conscious choice to either be caught in that habitual tendency or not. The meditation teaches you how to let go of that suffering. I've had many teachers. I was in Asia for 12 years. I had a lot of teachers in this country. And almost all of the teachers were talking about suffering. That's the first noble truth, suffering. I even had one friend that gave a Dhamma talk, and he started out by saying, the Buddha taught us that life is suffering. And he didn't say any more. Quiet. Well, who here wants to experience more suffering? Right? I like the third noble truth. The third noble truth is the one that says, there's the cessation of suffering. Let's let that one go. There is suffering in life. That's true. I mean, you walk around at night and you stub your toe. There's a lot of pain. That's suffering. You can't always get what you want. That sounds like a song, doesn't it? And that's suffering. And what you get, you don't want. And that's suffering. But that doesn't mean that you have to indulge in it. That doesn't mean you have to make that suffering get so big that it overwhelms you. There is a cause of suffering. And the cause of suffering always is craving. Craving manifests as tension and tightness in your mind and in your body. Craving is the I like it, I don't like it mind. Now, when you start looking at meditation through different kind of eyes. What you'll start to notice is what the Buddha was interested in teaching was how mind's attention moves moment to moment. Why it does that, we don't care about why. How your attention is on your object of meditation, whatever that happens to be, and it gets distracted. How did that happen? What happened first? What happened after that? What happened after that? Now, as you start to notice that, you'll start to see that there is a definite process that happens, and it happens exactly in the same way every time. For instance, in order to see, you have to have good working eyes. There has to be color and form. The good working eye hits the color and form, and eye consciousness arises. The meeting of these three is called eye contact. With eye contact as condition, eye feeling arises. Feeling is pleasant, painful, neither painful nor pleasant. Doesn't have anything to do with emotions. Feeling is just a feeling. Either it's a nice feeling, or it's not a nice feeling, or it's a neutral feeling. With eye feeling as condition, eye craving arises. Craving always manifests as tension and tightness in your mind and in your body. The craving is the I like it, I don't like it mind. That is the start of the false belief in a personal self. With eye craving as condition, clinging arises. Notice I didn't put eye clinging anymore because we're away from the that sense door now. The clinging is all of your thoughts, all of your opinions, all of your concepts, all of your ideas, all of the story about why you don't like that feeling. The clinging is where the big belief that this is personally yours happens. And then you have your habitual tendency. Your habitual tendency is every time this kind of feeling arises, I always act in that way. Now, I can tell you exactly how depression arises. I can tell you exactly how anxiety arises. I can tell you exactly how, whatever the catch of the day is, how it arises, because they all arise in the same way. There is contact, there is feeling, there's craving, there's clinging, there's your habitual tendency. Now, let's say depression. There's contact, this feeling arises and it's painful. Right on the feeling, right on the heels of this feeling, there is craving. I don't like that. I want it to stop. I want it to be different. And that tension starts to happen. And then there's all of these concepts and thoughts and ideas and your habitual tendency. Now, that is suffering. Okay. There are five things that make up this psychophysical process. You have a physical body, there is feeling, there is perception. Perception is the part of the mind that names things. You look at that and your mind says, that's a pillow. Okay, perception is that part of your mind that did that. You have thoughts and you have consciousness. When a painful feeling arises, our natural tendency is to try to think the feeling away. I don't like that. I want it to stop. The more you try to think a feeling, the bigger and more intense that feeling becomes. Why? Because it has something pushing against it, so it pushes back. And this is where that false idea of this is my emotion, this is my feeling, and I don't like it and I want it to be different. This is how the people that have depression, how it starts. It starts just with a feeling. I don't like the feeling, I want it to be different. Feeling gets bigger, oh, I have to do something about this, I don't want to talk to anybody, I'm going to lay down in bed and I'm going to hide. Maybe I should take some drugs. All of these kinds of things are because of our past habitual tendency of trying to think our feelings. But feelings are one thing and thoughts are something else. So, what do we have to do to overcome this problem? First, we have to let go of the thoughts about the feeling. When I say let go, I don't mean that you push them away. What I mean is that you allow those thoughts to be there, but you don't get involved in the story anymore. Now you relax. That tension and tightness in your head, in your mind, that is caused by this thinking. Now you see that there is a feeling there. And it can be big and it can be quite painful. But when a feeling arises, it's there. That is the truth. That is the Dhamma. What you do with the truth in the present moment dictates what happens in the future. If you try to control the truth with your thoughts, you can look forward to bigger and more intense pain, more intense suffering. Or, as you let go of that, you see that feeling, and you allow the space for that feeling to be there. You let go of that tight mental fist around the feeling. That tight mental fist is aversion. You don't like that feeling. You don't want it there. It's a natural thing to have aversion to a painful feeling. It's natural. But what we want to do now is see that aversion and the attachment to it. And what is the attachment? Oh, this is my pain. I want to control it. I want to make it the way I want it to be. No, we have to let that go. And allow that feeling to be there by itself. Let it float around. It wants to move from one knee to another. It wants to move from one emotion to another. Fine, it can do that. Doesn't matter. You don't keep your attention on it. Now you relax. When you relax, what you'll feel is, you've seen me do this a few times, what you'll feel is that your mind kind of expands. It's an expansion feeling, and then your mind takes a little step down and becomes very calm. When you let go of that tension and tightness, you have let go of craving. When you let go of craving, that is the cessation of suffering. When you relax, you'll feel your mind become very clear, very bright, very alert, and there's no thoughts in it. Now you bring that mind back to your object of meditation. Of course, that pain is going to come up again because we're attached to it. We've been attached to it for a long time. So you get to do it again. But this time, what you're going to do is look at how mind's attention moved from your object of meditation over here. How did that happen? Why is for psychologists? They can figure out why. As a Buddhist practitioner, your question is how. How does mind's attention move from one thing to another? As you become more familiar with how your mind's attention moves, you'll start to see little things that happen before you really get pulled away. And when you notice that, then you relax right then. So you're not pulled away for quite as long a period of time. And you come back to your object of meditation, and your mind starts to stay on your object of meditation a little bit longer. But it'll get pulled back again. And as you start recognizing how this process works, you'll start recognizing it more quickly, more easily, and you'll start letting go much better. Eventually, you let go and it just fades away. Now, what happens? Relief? Joy? Really strong. Uplifting joy. Your body feels incredibly light. Your mind is singing. Its mind is very light. Now, what do you do when joy arises? How many times have you been to a retreat and had someone tell you when joy arises, don't be attached? Sound familiar? Well, I'm here to tell you it's okay to have joy. And if you don't want to be attached to the joy, you treat that just like you treated the pain. Now it's a pleasant feeling. Okay, so you let that pleasant feeling be there and relax and come back to your object of meditation. The first time the joy like that arises, it's somewhat difficult to do that, I will admit. But that's all right. Right after the joy fades away, and it's not going to stick around forever, you feel very, very tranquil. You feel very comfortable in your mind and in your body. This is what the Buddha called happiness. Right after the happiness, your mind just stays on your object of meditation. Doesn't move at all. It's effortless effort. You can still have an occasional thought pull your mind away, but you see it really quickly and you let it go very easily and relax and then just come back. Now, what I just described to you was the first level or stage of understanding. And in this country, the Pali word is considered a dirty word. It's jhana. But the definition of jhana that I'm giving you is the one that the Buddha teaches. The definition of jhana that other people give you is, this is concentration. And you can never get to nibbana with this kind of concentration. They're talking about a different method of meditation that is not the same as what I'm showing you right now. The jhana practice is very necessary for your development of insight. Now, what you're learning every time you let go of that distraction and relax and come back and you see something that happens right before that, you are starting to see how the process of dependent origination actually does work. And the Buddha spent 45 years teaching Four Noble Truths and dependent origination. The way Buddhism is being taught right now by an awful lot of people, they have forgotten about the importance of dependent origination. And as a result, they talk about the end results being a lot different than what is described in the suttas. The end result by what is described in the suttas is always freedom and liberation, freedom from suffering. This meditation is immediately effective. That's one of the things that the Buddha, he talked about the Dhamma, and he said, this is immediately effective. I had a practice of 20 years doing the same thing that was really focused on suffering, and 20 years is not what I call immediately effective in a practice. Now, how do you have a practice that's immediately effective? We put these little brochures on the seats and all around. This is exactly the method you use for meditation. We're not talking about whether it's breathing meditation or loving kindness meditation, whatever kind of meditation you're doing. If you add these extra steps of relaxing and smiling, your meditation will take off. And you'll see that it's immediately effective. Anytime your mind has repeat thoughts in it, anytime your mind is very serious, there is an attachment. An attachment to what? An attachment to those thoughts and those feelings as being mine personally. That's me, that's mine, that's who I am. What the Buddha taught was that everything that arises is part of an impersonal process. And you get to see that more and more as you develop seeing how mind's attention moves. Okay, what's the definition of mindfulness? Anybody? It's one of those words like God. Everybody's supposed to know what it means, but nobody really agrees with what it means. So you get a lot of people that are talking about different things, but they're all using the same words, and it gets confusing. I will give you a definition of mindfulness. Mindfulness is remembering to observe how mind's attention moves from one thing to another. Okay, it's remembering to observe. I've taken, as I said in the past, I've taken a lot of retreats, And the last thing the teacher always said at the end of the retreat is, now go out into life and be mindful. They never told me during the whole retreat what mindfulness really was. And they let you, you're moving super slow, and that's called mindfulness. Well, I can't do that in my daily life. Does that mean I can't be mindful? Mindfulness is watching how mind's attention moves from one thing to another. Okay, differentiating between mindfulness and attention, mindfulness is the process of developing that attention. So, when you're practicing in your daily life, you still need an object of meditation. Now, I teach two different kinds of meditation. I teach mindfulness of breathing meditation, and I teach mindfulness of loving kindness meditation. They both lead to the same end result. One of them leads faster than the other. Loving kindness is a much faster progress in your meditation. And it's much easier to practice loving kindness meditation with your daily activities. Why? Because you've got a smile. Now, I've had some students that they did mindfulness of breathing with a one-pointed kind of concentration, access concentration and full absorption concentration. And they come and they say, well, I want to practice what you're teaching. And I say, fine, just add this extra step, but they invariably forget it and get back into the one-pointed concentration. Ah, this is so blissful, this is so peaceful, this is so calm. And yes, those are good states of mind, but what are you learning when your mind is just on the breath? Are you learning how mind's attention moves? No, it doesn't move because it's stuck to the breath. The instructions in the mindfulness of breathing. Now, I've written a book, and we have it out on the table there. You can grab a copy if you want. I've written a book on mindfulness of breathing. I wrote it 12 years ago. And I took the original teaching. I took that sutta on mindfulness of breathing and I went through the whole sutta explaining what it was talking about. The instructions in mindfulness of breathing are actually four sentences. And if you follow these four sentences exactly, you will have good progress in your meditation. Says, when you take a long in-breath, you understand you take a long in-breath. When you take a long out-breath, you understand you take a long out-breath. When you take a short in-breath, you understand. When you take a short out-breath, you understand. What's the key word here? Was it nostril? Was it nostril tip? Was it abdomen? Was it upper lip? No, you didn't hear me say any of that. It says you understand. That's the key word. You understand when you take a long breath and when it's short. You don't have to control your breath. Sometimes you naturally take a long breath and sometimes you don't, and that's okay. You understand that that's what you're doing. The next part is, the next two sentences, is the actual instruction in the meditation. It says, on the in-breath, you experience the entire body. On the out-breath, you experience the entire body. On the in-breath, you tranquilize the bodily formation. On the out-breath, you tranquilize the bodily formation. That's the instruction. It doesn't say that you become tranquil on the in-breath and out-breath. It says that you tranquilize What does that mean? Relax on the in-breath, relax on the out-breath. There's a distraction, let the distraction be, relax, come back to the breath, on the in-breath, relax, on the out-breath, relax. You're not focusing on the breath, you're using the breath as the reminder to relax. Every time you let go of tension and tightness in your mind and in your body, you are letting go of craving. Every time you let go of craving, you are experiencing the cessation of suffering. And the way leading to that cessation of suffering? Changing your perspective from I am that to it's only that. I'm mad. I have a lot of anger right now. Somebody said something to me and I don't like it. What happens in your mind? Tightness. Why? It's a painful feeling. And that craving got a hold of it. And all of the thoughts about why you don't like that and your habitual tendency. See, it's dependent origination again. The fastest way to let go of any attachment, I'm mad, I'm sad, I'm anxious, is to laugh. It's too simple. When you laugh, it changes your perspective from I am that to it's only this. That's easy to let go of. That's nothing. I don't need to hold on to that one. You start to see how joy starts to manifest when you do this. When you have joy in your mind is uplifted and it is wholesome. The more you can laugh, the more you can have fun with your daily life, the better your sitting meditation will become. Promise. Oh, I've had some students that have had some real major problems. They practice other kinds of meditation. I tell them they have to change the meditation. They still don't get it. Finally, okay, now the gloves come off. Now here's what I want you to do. I want you to smile all the time. And when you're not smiling, I want you to laugh. And anytime your mind gets serious, I definitely want you to laugh. And do that for 1 week. Do it all the time. 1 week. See how that changes your meditation. Your mindfulness becomes incredibly sharp. As you smile more and more, your mind becomes more and more uplifted. So when it starts to get heavy, you go, oh, no, we don't want to do that. That's not that important. Let's let it go. You're seeing the three characteristics intimately when you're smiling and when you laugh. You're seeing everything change. You're actually starting to change the world around you in a positive way. As you smile more, everybody else around you starts smiling more. As you feel peaceful and calm, everybody else around you starts to feel peaceful and calm. As you have a more open, accepting mind, everybody else around you has a more open, accepting mind. You affect the world around you. How are you going to do it? It's up to you. You want to affect it in a positive way? Smile more. And don't believe me. Do it. See if it works. I know from my personal experience it sure seemed to work for me. I've done weird things. I've gone into shopping malls and walk around with a sour face and watch how many people are not smiling. And then start smiling and watch how everybody you see start smiling, and they'll come up and they'll say nice things to you, and they'll do things that are truly amazing. And it's your choice. You can do it or not. How do you want to affect the world around you? I used to go to hospitals a lot. And the people that I would visit in the hospitals, they were really sick. They were getting close to death. They had cancer and it was eating their brain and all kinds of stuff. Now, if I go into a room where somebody is really suffering with a mind that starts to say, oh, you poor dear, I feel so sorry for you, how is that going to affect that person when I walk in? They want you to go away, quick. Their mind is already pulled down because of the pain. So what I did was I would practice smiling as I was going into the hospital, all the way to the room. And I was telling myself, no matter what their experience is, it's okay for them to have that experience. If it's fear, if it's anxiety, if it's pain, if it's dislike, it's okay for them to have that. It has to be okay because that's the truth for them. And I can't change their truth. The only thing I can control is what's happening in this body, in this mind. So I walk into the room and they might be moaning with pain and really experiencing a hard time. And I walk in and I smile and I say, hey, how's it going? And within 2 or 3 minutes, all of a sudden their mind is uplifted. And a lot of times I had people tell me, it's like fresh air coming into the room when you walk in. Because I'm completely accepting of their experience. And I'm loving them unconditionally. That's the definition of compassion. Compassion is allowing the space for another person to feel the way they're feeling and love them no matter what. I read an article in some magazine, I don't remember what it was. This guy wrote this article about compassion and how he was getting burned out from helping other people and trying to take their pain away. Well, it don't work. I can't take your pain away. Your pain is your pain. My pain is my pain. And it's okay. But I can love you. That way you don't burn out. And the more you can forgive and love another person, no matter what they say or what they do, you're giving them the space to change. Because you're not putting them in some little pigeonhole saying, you're this way always and you're always going to be like that. And because you have that idea in your mind, that's the way they always act. They don't want to let you down. The practice of loving kindness is the one that I like to teach the most, because one of the true advantages of this meditation is that your progress in the meditation is faster with loving kindness than it is with any other kind of practice. And I'm here to tell you, I don't care what your practice has been in the past, that practice that you had is not wasted time if you change to another kind of meditation. You'll start at the start, just like everybody, but you've already developed some degree of concentration and understanding of how your mind works. So your progress just starts to take leaps and bounds, and you will experience the jhanas. In the suttas, it talks about serenity and insight are yoked together. That means samatha practice and vipassana practice are yoked together. And you can experience both of them at the same time. You can be in a jhana and have insights into how mind's attention moves. And this is what I call, oh wow. We're going to be starting up a magazine soon, and I nobody likes this title but me. I like oh wow. Because that's what happens with the meditation. You get all of these, oh wow, that's really something. And as you understand on more and more subtle levels how the dependent origination works, every time you see that, you go, ah, this is great stuff. And you keep having these oh wows over and over. It's kind of comical, because people will come and they'll listen to me at a retreat and they'll hear me say basically the same thing over and over and over again. You got to relax and let it be and release it and let it be and relax and smile and stay with your object of meditation. They might hear me say that 300 or 400 times, and then they'll have the experience and they'll come up to me with this huge smile and they'll go, you know, I've heard you say this I don't know how many times, but now I understand what you're saying. Yeah, this is great stuff. And they'll go along a little bit, and then later they'll come in and they'll say, you know, I thought I knew what you were saying before, but now I really understand it. And that's the oh wows. And I love it. Do we want to do the sit now? I've been talking for a real long time. Okay? Okay, I'm going to teach you the loving kindness meditation now. And this is going to be different than any other kind of loving kindness meditation that you might have learned. The commentary type of loving kindness, they tell you you have to make 4 wishes, and you keep going over those wishes in your head. This kind of meditation that I'm going to show you is about feeling, not about mental running over the same things over and over again. When you make a wish, you make one wish. May I be happy. May my mind be peaceful and calm. May I be filled with joy. May my mind be clear and alert. Whatever wish you make, feel that wish. You know what it feels like to be peaceful and calm? then you take that feeling and you put it in your heart and you radiate that feeling. You know what it feels like to have a clear, accepting mind. Take that feeling, put it in your heart, radiate that feeling. You don't say the same wish over and over and over and over again very quickly. May I be happy, may I be happy, may I be happy. You don't do that. That will turn into a mantra, and then you'll start thinking about something else while you're just on the surface doing this. No, that's not meditation. Meditation is staying with your object of meditation. And your object of meditation is the feeling of loving kindness and making a wish and feeling that wish and putting that in that radiating feeling and radiate that to yourself. Now the first 10 minutes of the meditation will sit for how long? 40 minutes? Do you want to listen to me talk or do you want to sit longer? That's what. Yeah. How about 20? The first 10 minutes, you want to sit sending loving and kind thoughts to yourself. So you take yourself and you put yourself right in the middle of that feeling, that radiating, warm, glowing feeling. And you make a wish for your own happiness. Feel the wish, put the wish in your heart, surround yourself with that feeling. Give yourself a great big heart hug. Okay? Now, while you're sitting in meditation, please do not move your body at all for any reason. If you move your body, you have to start all over again. So we don't want to do that. If you move your body, that means that there's some kind of feeling that arose that you're trying to run away from instead of see. So we want you to sit very still. You can move as much as he does. While you're sitting like that, there can be some sensations that arise in your body. You might have a tickle in your throat and want to cough or sneeze. It can be an itch. It can be a heat, a vibration, or it can be actually pain. As soon as you notice that your attention has gone to that, the first thing that your mind does is start to think about the pain or that sensation. Geez, I wish it would stop. I wish it would go away. Why does it have to bother me now? Every thought about the feeling causes the feeling to get bigger and more intense. So the first thing you do is you let go of that feeling, or you let go of that thought, excuse me. You don't keep your attention on the thought. You just let the thought be there, but don't keep your attention on it anymore. Now relax the tension and tightness caused by that movement of mind's attention. That tension and tightness is in your head and in your mind. When you feel your mind kind of relax a little bit, you just do this one time, relax. If you don't feel that immediately, don't worry about it, it'll come. Then you notice that tight mental fist around the feeling. If you have a tight mental fist, I don't like that. I don't want it to be there. I want it to stop. Now, if you have a tickle in your throat, what you're going to notice is all of those muscles around your throat contract, get tight. So relax. If you're going to cough, let your body cough. It doesn't matter. What you're doing with your mind matters. If you have aversion to coughing, that's the fastest way to make the cough happen. So, you allow the feeling to be there, relax, smile. Come back to wishing yourself happiness and feeling that wish and surrounding yourself with that feeling. Now your mind is going to go back to that again. Same thing's going to happen. You're going to notice thoughts about it. Let it be, relax. Let the feeling be, relax. Come back to your object of meditation. It doesn't matter how long you do this. What you're trying to see is how mind's attention moved from your object to that sensation. How did it get there? What happened? As it goes, you keep bouncing back and forth between it, you'll start to see it. And that's part of the learning process. You are beginning to teach yourself how the dependent origination actually works. That's why I like this process, because I'm not your teacher. You're teaching yourself. I can give you some suggestions, I can guide a little bit, but you're doing all the work for yourself. Now, thoughts are not your enemy. It doesn't matter how many times your mind gets distracted away. As soon as you notice that your attention is pulled away and you're starting to think about something, you cannot criticize yourself. That's no fair. What you need to do is allow those thoughts to be there and relax. Gently come back to your object of meditation. After you started smiling again, this is a smiling meditation. Okay, you need to smile with your mind, smile with your eyes, even though your eyes are closed. You will notice that there's an incredible amount of tension in your face that when you relax and smile with your eyes, it disappears. Smile with your lips, a little bit, a Buddhist smile. Smile in your heart. Anytime you see yourself not smiling, please start again. This is a process of play it again, Sam. So just smile some more when you see you're not doing it. It doesn't matter how many times your mind gets distracted away. What matters is that when you notice that distraction, you let that distraction go, relax, and smile, and come back to your object of meditation. If you have a sitting where you have a distraction for 50 times, and 50 times you notice that, you let it be, relax, and come back, that is a good meditation. When you notice that you're thinking something and you get so involved in liking those thoughts and wanting to continue, now you're not meditating at all. Now you're thinking. So we want to try to be meditating as much as we possibly can. Okay, the more interest you have in sending loving and kind thoughts to yourself, the less likely you will have sloth and torpor arise. So be interested. This is a good thing you're doing. Like yourself for doing it. Appreciate yourself. After about 10 minutes, then you start sending loving and kind thoughts to a spiritual friend. A spiritual friend is someone of the same sex and they are alive. A spiritual friend is someone that when you think of them and their good qualities, you truly respect them and you truly appreciate them. You really do wish them well. So you're going along, may I feel peaceful and calm. As I feel peaceful and calm, I wish this for you. May you be peaceful and calm. Take your friend, see them in your mind's eye, put them right in the middle of your heart. Surround them with that peaceful and calm feeling. Give them a very gentle heart hug. Whenever the feeling starts to fade, then you can make another wish. And it can be the same wish, or you can change the wish, but don't change too often. So this is a little bit different than what a lot of people are teaching for loving kindness, because this focuses very much more on the feeling of loving kindness. Every time you make a wish, then relax any tension or tightness in your head. Keep that wish going as long as you can. But don't be critical of yourself. Smile and give that smile to your friend. Practice your generosity that way too. You smile to yourself and you smile to your friend. Okay, we're going to sit for 20 minutes and I'll let you know when. Because your mind will become infatuated with that person if it's a person of the opposite sex. And you don't want it to be a family member or somebody that you're living with. You want it to be someone that you truly respect, but there's some distance away, not real close to you. This is a training period. There will be a time when you'll be able to do that with other close members of the family and all of that. But first you have to develop some equanimity in your mind.
What if I don't have a spiritual friend that I feel like that? What kind of habit is something that I don't know very well?
I had one student that she said this is when Sister Teresa was alive. She said, can I use her for my spiritual friend? Is she alive? Is it a person of the same sex? That's the criterion. Okay? Now you stay with the same spiritual friend all the time. And I'll talk more about that in a little bit. Okay, let go of your meditation and gently open your eyes whenever you're ready. Can you feel how much lighter your mind is now? See, that's the whole point of the meditation, is to have an uplifted mind all of the time. When you practice your mindfulness and you see you're getting serious, there is an attachment there that you're not being alert to. So, start smiling again. You'll see that once you start doing this and you start making it your regular practice, the six R's is a very natural process of recognizing when your mind is distracted, letting go of that distraction, relaxing, smiling, coming back to an object of meditation. Now, this meditation is not just about sitting on the cushion. This is about all the time practice. With your daily activities, anytime you see your mind's not smiling, then start smiling some more. It's okay to have fun. Isn't that weird? When was the last time you heard a monk say that? It's okay to smile. So the more you have this kind of uplift in mind, the more you're aware of what is my mind is doing in the present moment. And the more you're aware of that with your daily activities, the more you'll start to recognize when a hindrance arises and how to let that hindrance go. See, there's this kind of meditation that's currently being taught quite often, and it has to do with absorption concentration. I call it one-pointed concentration. Any practice that does not have the relaxing step in it is one form or another of that one-pointed concentration.
I don't know if it's that I've been practicing one form of meditation so much, but I noticed that when I find my mind wandering off, it's like this reaction just to come back to the breath.
Well, old habits hard to let go of. Be patient. And when you see that you did that, then relax right then. Okay? Now, you don't want to have a practice where you relax, 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 relax. That doesn't work. Promise. Relax one time. If the tension is still there, your mind will get pulled back to the cause of that tension, and you get to do it again. So it's not... You can't use this meditation as a club to beat distractions away. It doesn't work. The meditation is about learning how to lovingly accept whatever is in the present moment and relax into that. If there's no relaxation at that moment, still, you bring that mind back to your object of meditation, your mind will go back to that distraction again. That tension will stay there as long as there's an attachment to it. But as you let go more and more, it will start to get weaker and weaker. Now, when you're practicing one-pointed concentration, one of the disadvantages of doing that, and this includes access concentration. The disadvantage is it stops your mind from having hindrances arise. Okay, the force of the concentration is strong enough that it will stop the hindrance. Now the hindrance is where your attachments are. So if you push those down, now you're not really learning how you get caught by the hindrances. So when you lose that concentration in your daily life, all of a sudden, the hindrance comes up big time. And then there's this problem. I've seen people that practice one-pointed concentration become very, very self-centered. I've seen people that practice one-pointed concentration become very, very critical of other people. Now, this is a hard mind. It's not an open, accepting mind. This is a mind that's tight and says, I know you don't know. Pay attention to me. I'm the one in control. Anytime you see somebody that has that kind of mind, you can very well suspect that they're practicing some form of one-pointed concentration. When you learn how to relax into things, it never stops a hindrance from arising. You can be in a jhana and your mindfulness slips a little bit. Now you got a hindrance to work with. You're not in the jhana anymore. As you become more and more familiar with the hindrances arising, you start to see more and more clearly how this process works. You start to really begin to appreciate hindrances and be thankful for them arising. Yes. Okay. A hindrance is any kind of distraction that pulls your mind away from your object of meditation. The Buddha talked about five general kinds. He said you have lust or greed, hatred, aversion, sleepiness, dullness, restlessness, anxiety or remorse, doubt, perplexity. Now the doubt is whether you're doing the practice correctly or not, or whether this is the right practice for you or not. Now the thing with the hindrances is that they don't just come one at a time. They like to beat up on you. They like to gang up on you. You get a feeling of restlessness, you don't like that feeling. Oh, that's two hindrances right there, isn't it? So you let go and relax. Every wandering thought is a hindrance. Now what is a wandering thought? A wandering thought is a thought about the past or the future. You can have observation thoughts about the present moment. They're not the unwholesome kind of thoughts. And you do that while you're sitting. You say, oh, mind is very peaceful and calm right now. Okay, and you just let them go back to your object of meditation. That's an observation thought. But when you start getting into, you know, yesterday my sitting was a lot better than it is today, and all of a sudden you go further and further and further away from your object of meditation, and you're 1,000 miles away. Now as soon as you recognize that, you let it be, you relax, you come back. You gotta be real familiar and make these hindrances your friends, because they are your teachers. They're showing you exactly where your attachments are, and they're gonna stay around until you let go of that attachment. Which means you gotta be friendly with them, not fight with them. Not try to control them, not try to make them be what you want them to be. You have to learn how to relax into it and watch how that process works of the hindrance arising. That's the most important part of the meditation, is to be able to observe how mind's attention moves from one thing to another. And when you start seeing that more and more clearly, you start seeing that it's a lot of little pieces that come together, that arise and pass away. Now, a lot of people will say something about suffering or something about pain. You know, you're sitting and all of a sudden you have this pain arise in your knee or your back or wherever it happens to be. For years and years, I used to have this real interesting sensation of being like I was being stabbed in the arm. It was real intense. Finally let it go. It doesn't happen anymore. But you say, well, this pain is here and that's distracting me. But what is a pain? A pain is a concept. Just like an automobile is a concept. You go out there in the parking lot and you say, this is my automobile. Where is the automobile? Is it the windscreen? Is it the front, the door? Is it the steering wheel? Is it the wheels? Is it the motor? Is it the turn signals? No, it's a lot of different little things put together to make up this concept. Pain is the same thing. It's a lot of little things put together to make up that concept. When pain arises, I've had teachers that tell me, ah, pain is your best friend. Does that sound familiar? Yeah, your mind doesn't waver once you got pain. You should always sit with pain. I got to a place when I was in Burma where my equanimity was so strong that I couldn't make pain arise. And I sat in all kinds of very peculiar positions to make that pain come up, and I couldn't do it. And I went to the teacher and I complained. That's how brainwashed I was. I don't want you to sit in a way that causes a lot of pain to come up. Now there's two different kinds of pain. There is meditation pain and there is real pain. Meditation pain, you have a pain in your knee, a pain in your back, you get up and you start walking away and you forget about the pain. You don't even notice that it's there. A real pain, it doesn't go away. Don't sit in a way that causes the pain to arise. Now, I told you the story about that woman that practiced the meditation. The first time she ever did a retreat, she could only sit for 45 minutes because the pain was so intense. She sat in a way that there wasn't any pain arising, and she got into the first jhana. You don't need to make pain arise. Any meditation practice that you do, if you don't have this relaxing step in it, it is a form of one-pointed concentration. That is with Tai Chi, Qi Gong, all of those different things are forms of one-pointed concentration unless you consciously put that relaxed step in. And then that will change the entire meditation. When you're doing your daily activities, when you're practicing loving-kindness meditation, that means that you want to focus on sending loving kindness all the time. You have to walk from here to your car. What are you doing with your mind? Some of this, some of that, thinking this, gotta go there, gotta do that. Let go of all of that. Start smiling and wishing somebody happiness. It doesn't matter whether it's all beings or the people that are around you. You can radiate loving kindness to anybody. When you're doing your sitting meditation, the same spiritual friend all the time. But when you're doing your daily activities, it doesn't really matter. Don't look another person in the eye and radiate loving kindness to them. They will misunderstand that. Okay, so just be careful with that. But you get in line at the supermarket. What are you doing with your mind? Let go of that. Start radiating loving kindness to everybody around you. Wish them all happiness. Every time I go into a store, I kind of have a radar that says, oh, there's a little one. I want to go make that one smile. And if they're being crabby, those are the ones I want to come up and really spend time with. Mm-hmm. And Mom really appreciates that. Yeah.
You mentioned simply focusing concentration, which is intently to focus on something. Then you said object of meditation. They aren't the same.
No.
What's the object?
When you're doing the loving kindness, your object of meditation is the loving-kindness feeling, that radiating feeling, and making a wish and relaxing into that. Okay? One pointed concentration means that you're focusing on one thing only. I know that there's a lot of people, especially when you're in college, you can get so intent in reading a book that somebody can come up to you and start talking and you didn't even hear them because you were so focused on that. And that's not a bad thing. It's just the end result is not the same as what the Buddha was teaching. The end result that the Buddha was trying to get us to experience was the letting go of the tension and tightness all of the time. And when we do that, our mind becomes exceptionally clear, exceptionally bright. Hindrances, they won't be a problem. They'll just start fading away more and more as you practice. Now, the advantage of practicing this tranquility kind of meditation is you become very familiar with how the hindrance arises with your sitting practice. So that when you go out there and a hindrance arises, you're not going to be caught with it for as long. You're going to be able to recognize it more easily. You'll be able to let go of it more quickly. You know, I've known people that get angry at somebody and they'll stay angry for huge amounts of time. What are they doing to themselves by holding on to that anger and that dissatisfaction? What are they doing to themselves? They're causing themselves a lot of suffering because of that attachment. I'm mad and I'm not going to forgive that person because they did me wrong. Well, what good does it do to hold on to those kind of thoughts and those kind of feelings? They keep coming up over and over again, so you suffer multiple times. Yeah, but they deserve my anger. You know, one of the verses in the Dhammapada says that hatred can never be overcome by hatred. Hatred can only be overcome by love. I like to change that a little bit and say aversion can never be overcome by aversion. Aversion can only be overcome by loving acceptance. Loving acceptance means that your mind is soft. Any aversion in your mind hardens your mind, and it hardens your heart. Now, when you're practicing loving kindness meditation, there was a guy in Japan that started fiddling around with water. Have you heard about him? I can't think of his name right off, but he held a glass of water and he practiced loving kindness and then he flash froze it with nitrogen and took a picture of it under a microscope. And there's this perfect little snowflake. I mean, it's just gorgeous. And then he tried it with other mental states, and you could see it with all of this. Now, you're practicing loving kindness. Your body has about 70% water in it. What are you doing with your body? Starting to heal it. The more you can practice having this uplifted, happy mind, the more healthy you will become. Yes. Okay, I've been talking with a couple of people today about how you practice forgiveness. Okay, forgiveness is one of the most powerful meditations that I know of. And you start out this way. You have to forgive yourself. I forgive myself for not understanding. I forgive myself for making mistakes. I forgive myself for not being perfect. I forgive myself for causing pain to anyone, myself included. Now, you sit and you take one of those statements and you repeat it in your mind, and then you have a feeling of that, and you put that feeling of forgiveness in your heart and radiate that feeling. Now, your mind is going to have some resistance to that. It's going to say, no, I don't buy that. I'm not going to do that. No. And you have to notice that your mind has this aversion in it, and you let it be, and you relax, and then do it again. No, I really do forgive myself. After you do this for a period of time, there will be people that have, quote, done you wrong in the past. And they'll come up into your mind, and you'll start thinking about this person. So now you take this person as your object of meditation, and you forgive them. You look them straight in the eye, and you say, I forgive you for not understanding. I forgive you for making mistakes. I forgive you for causing pain. I really do. Now you can still have a lot of resistance coming up, and your mind is saying, because of the attachment, your mind will say, no, I ain't going for this. So you let that thought go, and you come back to the forgiveness. Now you have to have the smile, and you have to have the relaxing in this. Then, after a period of time, then you hear them say, I forgive you for one of those statements, for not understanding or causing pain. So what you're doing is you're forgiving yourself, you're forgiving another person, and they're forgiving you. That completes the cycle. And then you go back to forgiving yourself again. And the forgiveness meditation is one that you take into your daily activities. Somebody says something you don't like, you have to forgive them right then. You do something to your body. You're chopping vegetables and you cut yourself. You forgive yourself right then. You stub your toe. You bang your shin. Whatever. Forgive right then. No matter what anybody says, if it starts to make your mind hard, you forgive them right then. As you do this forgiveness meditation all the time, you're letting go of attachments. And the attachment is, I want things to be the way I want them to be. And I want it right now. Okay? What you're starting to do is you're starting to let go of that attachment to I am that. See, the clinging, it has your ideas, your concepts, and your opinions in it. And that strong belief that I'm right. For instance, when you first go to work in the morning, feeling pretty good, somebody comes up to you and they read the Riot Act. And they're angry at you, and they're really very unhappy. Now, what is the natural thing to do? Well, the natural thing to do is to take their anger, make it my anger, and then throw it back at them. Now you're in a full-scale war. And then they walk away. What do you think about? What I said? What they said? What I should have said? I'm right, they're wrong. And then a little while later, what do you have happen in your mind again? Same thing. Like it's on a tape deck. Anytime you have repeat thoughts, there is an attachment there. So, what can you do so that you don't have this problem? Let's continue on with this scenario a little bit further. You go home, or the rest of the day, you're not really very happy, and you kind of snap at people. And then you go home and you say, leave me alone, I've had a rotten day. And then you go to sleep and you toss and turn. And you get up the next day and you're groggy. And you go into work and you're not even wide awake yet. Okay? All of this happened because of something that happened in the past. And eventually you'll forget about it until that kind of situation happens again, and then you have your old anger and dissatisfaction and suffering, and you put that on the new one, so it makes it more intense. So what we have to learn to do is how to break the cycle. And you break the cycle with forgiveness. Somebody can come up to you and they can start giving you their anger. You have the choice of either taking their anger and making it yours and giving it back to them or not. It's your choice. You can send loving kindness to that person. You can send your forgiveness. I forgive you for not understanding the situation. I forgive you for being angry. I forgive you for having all of this pain. I wish you happiness. Now, one of two things is going to happen. Either that person is going to go away grumbling to themselves, or they're going to calm down, and then you can find out what the real problem is, because it's not what they were talking about. But what happens to you? They go away grumbling. Your mind is very alert. Your mind is in the present moment. You're ready to, whatever else is going to happen, okay, I'm ready for it, and I can be happy while I'm doing it. One of the real scary things is to see two people that are arguing with each other a lot, and then they both get in a car and drive away. That's absolutely frightening. Why? Because they're not driving. You want to see an accident happen? Guess what? That's how it happens. Because you're not paying attention to what you're doing while you're doing it with an alert mind that's uplifted. So the more you can focus on forgiving and relaxing into that and seeing how your concepts and opinions affect you, sometimes positively, sometimes negatively, but it always kind of knocks you off balance. The meditation is about learning balance. I've had a lot of students that have gotten fairly deep in the meditation, and they'll experience this very, very deep state of equanimity. And they'll come in for an interview, and I say, well, how's it going? And they say, everything is fine. Are you having any troubles doing it? No trouble. Everything is just fine. Now this is a state that you can develop all the time. See, it's not just while you're doing the meditation. When I teach you the meditation, I'm teaching you how not only to get into these deep states while you're sitting, but how to get up from that and keep that meditation going while you're doing other things. It takes practice and you'll forget, and that's okay, just start again. It all comes from the smile. It all comes from having an uplifted mind. The more you practice having joy in your mind, the more alert you become when mind gets heavy. The easier it is to let go of that. And life really does become fun. Honest. I wouldn't kid you about this. Yeah.
What I'm hearing about the six R's is it sounds like a process. Is that a state of being?
Yes.
Or is doing this process leading to other states of being?
It's a state of mindfulness that leads to the cessation of suffering. Okay. Now, a lot of people, when they first see this, they think that you have to verbally do everything, and it's not a verbal practice. It's just recognizing, releasing, relaxing, smiling, coming back. No. No. Every time you relax, you're experiencing the cessation of suffering. Okay, that doesn't mean that you quit living. It doesn't mean that this is some way out state. It means that you're letting go of tension and tightness. I mean, you make a fist in your hand and you say, how am I going to let go of that tension in my hand? You do that by recognizing that your hand was tight and the muscles had to be relaxed before you could open up your hand. This is basically showing you the same thing. You will get to the super mundane state of the cessation of suffering, but it's only going to last for a short period of time. You don't have a choice whether you come back or not. It's automatic, you do. But there is a change in personality where you won't have any lust or hatred ever arise in you again. Ever. Now think about that. Never to be mad at anybody for anything ever again. In this lifetime. Getting to the cessation of suffering doesn't mean that you don't, you're still not passionate about things, but you don't have the emotions that cause suffering arise anymore. You still have happiness, that's an emotion. You still have uplifted mind, you still have joy, you still have equanimity, those are all emotions. But these are the ones that don't lead to suffering. These are the ones that lead to more and more calm and understanding of how this process works. Until your body dies, it's going to have an arising and passing away of phenomena. Okay? And that is considered suffering, yes. Even the Buddha, after he became completely awake, because he had a body, that was still some suffering. But it didn't make his mind shake. It didn't make his mind tight, because there was no craving. And as soon as he died, there was no more becoming. Well, there's different levels of suffering, of course. But the Buddha had physical suffering. He had pains in his back. And they were so intense at the end of his life, he could only give a Dhamma talk for so long and then he had to lie down. And he suffered greatly right before he died. He had dysentery. He could only walk 5 or 6 paces before he had to sit down and rest again until he got to where he was going to go. There was physical suffering, but it did not affect his mind. Okay. Okay, that's a good question. How do you work with grief? As you sit with that grief, you start seeing how your mind doesn't like that situation, and it tightens around the situation, and then you start having a lot of thoughts about dissatisfaction of that happening. A child dies or a family relative dies, there is going to be real pain there. There's going to be real suffering there for a period of time. But as you start relaxing and letting that feeling be there, even as big and as intense as it is, as you relax into that, the thoughts about that start fading away. And that's the thing that causes the grief to last so long and cause a lot of physical problems for people. I used to work at a hospice, and I saw firsthand how if people didn't let go and relax into whatever feeling it was that arose, that they would try to push mind down with mind and stop this pain, and they become distracting and they start developing a one-pointed kind of concentration that pushes down that pain. But what happens in about a year and a half or 2 years is some major problem happens in their body because they didn't release all of this dissatisfaction, dislike, and pain. They identified with it and tried to push it down. So the pain is there. Okay, when pain arises, it's there. That's the truth. Anytime you try to change the truth or fight with the truth, or make the truth be the way you want it to be, that's the cause of suffering. Okay? Now, you'll still have the memory of that person dying, and there can be sadness, but it doesn't have to be painful. It doesn't have to be suffering. Because you've let go of that desire and that craving and that clinging. You've let go of that. So you still have the memory of that, but it doesn't make you sad. You see what I'm saying? As you relax into that, yes, it is painful, but the only way you can handle that situation is by learning how to lovingly accept that this is real and it's happened. And relax into that. As you do that, the suffering fades away and disappears. And you can still have pictures of your relatives and talk with them and do whatever, but it doesn't hurt because you've let go of the suffering. Well, actually, no. They don't happen at exactly the same time. One thing happens at a time.
But that bracing around not wanting to see, that's the real
suffering. Right. That's what suffering really is. Sadness is sadness. That is a feeling. It's an unpleasant feeling. When it arises, the truth is it's there. What you do with what arises in the present moment dictates what happens in the future. If you fight with that feeling, if you try to control that feeling and make that feeling be the way you want it to be, you can look forward in the future to having more suffering. Or you can accept the fact that that is painful feeling and relax into it and allow that painful feeling to do whatever it's going to do without trying to control it and without tightening around it. Then in the future there is no more suffering because you've let go of the attachment. Right. Right. And it has to be a conscious allowing and relaxing and letting that sorrow, sadness, just tear your heart out. And it's okay, because your heart can take it as you relax into that. And it's not easy. I'm not suggesting that it is. But what else can you do? You can fight with it or not. That's your choice. As you learn to lovingly accept, then there's no more war. There's no more fight. There is peace that comes eventually. Okay? See, it comes back to what I was saying with the five aggregates. Feeling is one thing and thoughts are something else. And every time you try to control a feeling with thoughts, that's the cause of suffering. Okay, the feeling can be big, it can be intense. But as you allow that to be there without trying to control it with your thoughts, because you can't, then eventually that feeling has a space to change. And it will fade away, but you'll still have a memory of that, but you won't have the suffering involved with it. Well, but I wouldn't use those words with you at that time. What I would suggest that you do would be start relaxing your thinking and allowing that feeling just to do whatever it's going to do without your trying to control it. And like I said, it's not easy. I have lost family members, and I'm here to tell you it's not easy. It's hard. There is suffering in life, and there's all different levels of suffering. My teacher died just two years ago, something like that. And He was my best friend. It was hard to see him not there anymore. And as I saw my mind tighten around that, I had to learn how to lovingly accept the fact that this is real and it's okay for it to be like that. It has to be okay because that's the truth. As much as I didn't want him to die, he did. As much energy as I put into giving him, it didn't work. And that had to be okay in my mind, or I would be suffering right now. But it is okay. Yeah.
And do you find it helpful to do things like noting feelings, like when sadness comes up, say, oh,
no.
Sadness. You don't find it helpful?
No. See, that you're already getting into, when you start verbalizing, you're already into the clinging. Mm-hmm. And you're into the thinking. And when, no, that doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. It's still, you're still into that thinking mind. When you're more and more used to how mind works, you see the feeling arise, and you relax it right then. It doesn't matter what kind of feeling it is. It's painful, it's pleasant, it's not either, but it doesn't matter. You treat it all in the same way. And when your awareness becomes sharp enough to be able to see that feeling just start to arise and you relax right then, there's a certain kind of freedom that comes in. There's a certain kind of clarity of mind that is just unbelievable. And it is a desirable state to be in when you don't have any craving. Yeah.
You spoke earlier about loving kindness, and first projecting that feeling for yourself, and then of course spiritual friends.
Yeah. Oh, the reason that you need to use the same spiritual friend all the time is because there are certain things that you will go through when you stay with that friend. You'll go through a period of boredom and I don't want to do this anymore, and all of these states, they are steps in the progress. And you stay with that spiritual friend until you get to strong equanimity, which means that that would be up to the fourth jhana. Yeah.
See, what sounds like what you're actually doing is you're having a relationship in your practice, having a relationship with your spiritual friend, throughout your version of thoughts.
Well, yeah, it's true. But you got to learn to go through the boredoms and the dissatisfactions, because on the other side of that hindrance, there's a relief. And there's you feel your practice getting deeper. Unfortunately, when you're practicing meditation, the hardest part of the meditation is when you first start out. That's true when you've never meditated before or when you change to another kind of meditation. It'll be difficult at first. But as you go through that difficulty and the aversions and that sort of thing, you start developing your meditation more and more, you'll start flying through the different stages. I gave a meditation retreat in in the LA area, and it was for 2 weeks. And 2 weeks is almost too long for a meditation retreat, I think. Now, this is from somebody that's done 12 or 15 3-month retreats. You don't need to go, really about 10 days is just about right. You've learned a lot in 10 days, and then you need to be able to take it home. And as you continue on with your practice, you'll start to go deeper and deeper, and then you start to get into the Brahma Viharas, the compassion and joy and equanimity. And as you go deeper, then you'll experience neither the cessation of perception and feeling, and eventually Nibbana. This does lead to Nibbana. And I understand that the commentaries say that loving kindness will only take you to the third jhana. You can't get any higher than that. But the suttas say it'll take you to the fourth jhana. And I've read books that the commentaries say, well, when you get done with loving kindness and you want to do compassion, you got to start back at the first jhana, and you'll only get to the third jhana. The suttas say you're going to get into the first arupa jhana with compassion. So this is a lot different than the way the loving kindness is being taught. And this is a direct path to the experience of Nibbana, I promise. And you're hearing me give a Dhamma talk every day. Now we have some books and we have some CDs that are MP3s. And there's some regular CDs on how to practice loving kindness with your daily activities. Feel free to take those. The MP3 has a phenomenal number of hours of talks. And if you want to join our Yahoo group, any kind of question you have with your practice, I'll try to get back to you as soon as I can, although that's difficult while I'm traveling. But we do give online retreats where you can take the precepts and do your sitting in the morning, go to work, sit in the afternoon, come home, sit, listen to a Dhamma talk, but you have to write to me every day and let me know what your practice is so that I can help you. And we do this for 7 days, and I'm frankly shocked at how well people do with these. I try to get you to keep your practice going all the time. I want you to smile. I want you to laugh. I want you to give that smile away as much as you possibly can remember to. Yeah. Well, that's the fastest way not to have the next jhana. And you see, the whole thing, this is a process that really works very naturally. You'll get into a jhana and you'll be able to stay there for a little while. And if you get out and you want to sit in that jhana again, you'll start trying too hard and you have restlessness. Now the restlessness is because you're putting too much energy into it. Now, you start working with the restlessness and see how that arises, and when you let go of that hindrance, now you're going to go deeper into your meditation and you'll get to the next jhana. So this is a very natural kind of process. And it can happen so fast. I mean, in a week, it's not a shock to me to see people get into the fourth jhana in a week. It doesn't surprise me at all. What does surprise me is somebody comes and they do the retreat and they don't get into a jhana. That surprises me. And that's generally because they're not following the directions and they're wanting to do it the way they want to do it. And I'm going to mix this with that, and they don't have any progress. And each of the jhanas, you're learning how to adjust the amount of energy that you're putting into watching. Okay? So you're learning how to do this balance. And as you go deeper, that balance really becomes a fine, fine thing. And it's quite interesting. But you will learn that you don't put the same amount of energy in to watching your meditation every time. Because if you try to do that, then you'll get all kinds of hindrances. You have to learn how to tweak the amount of energy you're putting in. And the way you tweak it is by your interest in sending your loving kindness to your friend, not letting your mind ho-hum around. The interest that you have in sincerely wishing your friend well will help you to see how to balance your energy. And you'll be able to catch it more and more quickly. And you say, oh, I'm trying a little bit too hard. Let's relax on that and see how it goes. Ah, that's better. Yeah. It's all of the Four Noble Truths. Since I've written that book, I've learned more about the Four Noble Truths. Okay, and the Four Noble Truths is a method of deduction, of seeing each one of the links of dependent origination. And you'll see that there's a cause, and you'll see what the link is, what the cause is, how the cessation happens, and the way to the cessation. So that happens with all of the Four Noble Truths. Okay? Let's share some merit now. May suffering ones be suffering free, and the fear-struck fearless be. May the grieving shed all grief, and may all beings find relief. May all beings share this merit that we have thus acquired for the acquisition of all kinds of happiness. May beings inhabiting space and earth, devas and nagas of mighty power, share this merit of ours. May they long protect the Buddha's dispensation. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.